Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good, things are coming your way.
This is Ridgeway Magazine with me, John Shepherd, and Andy Venton. Good morning. Now then, the wars between British and French fishermen are nothing new, as we hear from a trawler skipper who has experienced at first hand being attacked at sea. We have an edition of Pet Patter, and the subject is Cyril the Squirrel. And pause for laughter. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I didn't invent Cyril the Squirrel. And we take our Ridgeway Magazine outside broadcast unit to Mad Hatter Day in Bridport last weekend.
Wonderful. Now then, Dorset is rich in military history, military vehicle collectors and collections. Well, we talk to the owner of a small tank who drives around collecting money for Help the Heroes. Ever fancied owning a World War II Jeep? Well, we go to Portland to meet the man who restores them from the wheels up.
Well, fishing wars are in the news again. I saw a dreadful tabloid newspaper heading recently which read Crash Bang Scallop, and introducing the latest spat between French fishermen and our own trawler's crews. There are confrontations. Well, they've been going on for years and years because of the complicated rules, and you can blame the EU in part for this, about whose fishermen can fish for what, where, and at what time of the year. But these sea battles between aggrieved fishermen are very serious if you happen to be in the middle of a confrontation. They can have very serious consequences for trawlermen, as one time West Country skipper Dick Harvey told Ridgeway Magazine by telephone.
Now, these fishing wars are nothing new, and I'm talking to a former trawler skipper, West Country trawler skipper, Dick Harvey, about his experiences quite a few years ago now when he was threatened by the fishing fleet from France. Dick, tell me more about that.
Yeah, it was probably mid-90s, I suppose, 93, 94, 95, maybe, I can't quite remember. But four or five of us were fishing south of the Scilly Isles with static hake nets, which we would shoot a mile at a time. And there was quite a few Frenchmen in the area, and they decided, once we give them the readings of where the nets were on the seabed, that we must have been on decent fishing, so they just turned their attentions on us and trawled right through and smashed our gear to pieces.
So, basically, when you say you've got a mile's worth of nets on the seabed, and they just drove straight through them.
That's right, yeah. They would just look to either take the end of, say, your southwest end. They would try and either take the southwest end away so you couldn't pick your gear up, or they would go for the middle, hoping to tow away or do as much damage as possible and possibly catch what fish you were on.
So the other aspect of this is that I believe you were threatened, weren't you, in a particularly nasty way?
Well, we went up alongside one to see if we could try and find out what was going on, to try and communicate that where all the nets were. And this big Frenchman came out on the side of the wheelhouse and he had a shotgun in his hand, which we thought, well, we'd better beat a hasty retreat and call the fisheries protection vessel.
So was there a fisheries protection vessel in the area?
We managed to get HMS Lindisfarne down, and she calmed the situation down and chased them all away, but once she'd done what she was asked to do, she decided to head up towards Lundy, and once she was out of sight, they all came back. It started again.
Right. Now, what do you make of the scallop wars that have been happening over the last few days? They've changed, haven't they? The tactics have changed a bit, because it seems to me, from the pictures I've seen in the press, that the ships have got far closer than in your day, because you had a mile's worth of nets, but this seems to be very up close and personal.
Well, like I say, we had confrontations, and there was lots of name calling and hand gestures, if you will. But now it seems to have gone up a gear, and anything goes, whether they're throwing things, or there seems to be flares or smoke bombs. Someone mentioned petrol bombs, but I don't think that's true. I mean, I might be wrong, but you never know. I mean, flares are probably being used now. Someone is going to get hurt, or a vessel is going to go down, and lives are going to be lost.
When you talk about flares, I mean, can firing flares at a trawler, can that cause a fire?
You certainly wouldn't want one to land somewhere where you've got a lot of kit stored, which is dry, because it would go up. Simple as that.
Now, what is the effect, then, on a trawler skipper's livelihood and that of his crew when the nets are deliberately cut and destroyed?
Well, if you're working the boat for a company, then the company really has to foot the bill, but it will come out of your wages somewhere along the line, i.e. in percentages. And if you are the skipper owner, well, then you indirectly take a big hit, and then the crew are going to take a hit, because loss of earnings plus time ashore mending and resetting new gear, which you don't get paid for.
So what is the cost then? I mean, obviously there is a cost in terms of loss of catch and loss of earnings, but how much does, I'd say, a mile of fish netting cost?
Oh, God. Then I suppose we was talking about a couple hundred quid per 100 yards, and we're talking a mile, so it's going to run into thousands, depending on how much you lose. But nowadays, the price is going to be more, because obviously everything has probably doubled or tripled since I was at sea.
So, who do you think is to blame, then, for this latest spat in the Channel?
Well, I know what I'd like to say, but I better not.
Oh, go on.
Because Whitehall are probably listening, but, you know.
I'd be very surprised if Whitehall are listening to keep...
But the French are cunning. They will come into within 6, 7, 8 mile of our shore, and if we get to within 12 mile of theirs, it's free-for-all. So I think it should be one for one and one for all, really.
Right. So obviously this isn't helping Brexit negotiations any, is it? Because fishing has actually been quite important in terms of Brexit. Well, but we'll leave that for another day, Dick, because...
Okay.
But thank you very much indeed for sharing your thoughts.
No problem.
And so I suppose you're quite glad you're not a fisherman anymore, are you?
I miss it now and again, but not as much as I used to, put it that way.
Right. Well, thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgeway Magazine.
Well, those of us with long memories may remember the Cod Wars of the 1950s and 1970s. In these, the British fishing fleet was at war with Iceland over the right to fish for cod and whitefish in the North Atlantic. It was a very serious dispute, with the Royal Navy deploying nearly 40 warships to protect the fishing fleet. It was reported that the Icelandic Coast Guard deliberately cut the nets of our trawlers, and rifle fire was heard. The latest argument with the French is nothing new. There have been disputes for the last 200 years, and this is one for the history buffs. After the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, the French took advantage of the lack of any clear laws about territorial waters to dominate commercial fishing close to the Kent and Sussex coastline. It was sorted out eventually after a parliamentary investigation was set up. In 1904, Britain almost went to war with Russia, which was having its own war with Japan at the time. Off the Kent coast around the Dogger Bank fishing grounds, the Russian Navy opened fire on British North Sea fishermen, mistaking them for hostile Japanese ships. There was thick fog at the time, and the Russians, being told of their mistake, apologised. Fishing is dangerous enough without going to war over a basket of scallops. And do you say scallops, as in wallops, or scallops, as in collapse? John, tell me.
Well, I did actually ask the BBC, and they said they couldn't make their mind up. But we do like to be so precise on Ridgeway Magazine, don't we? And we'd go to no ends of the earth to find out answers. Dunno.
Keep 106.
Well now, here is a complete change of pace as we join Ridgeway Magazine's vet Malcolm Welshman for his latest pet patter. And the subject today is Cyril the Squirrel. And here he talks to John.
It was during a morning consultation at the vet clinic. I lifted the lid off a shoebox which two lads had brought in, parted the cotton wool inside, and I stared down at a vivid, pink-skinned baby squirrel. It was actually fat, barely 2 inches long. It had very dark, unopened eyes, huge claw-like feet. And apparently he'd been discovered in the remains of a dray that came crashing down when an oak tree was felled on the village green. He'd survived that downfall and looked really, really helpless lying there. So, guess what, John? I decided I'd try and raise him, didn't I?
Well, I mean, I can't see how you do it. So small, you must have had tiny little pipettes and milk. What did you use?
Well, that's it. I was wondering just how to do it, because I have to confess I'd never tried rearing a baby squirrel. And I constructed an artificial nest from some empty drugs cartons and suspended an infrared lamp across it for the warmth. My wife said, well, what are you going to feed him on? And I brandished a tin of milk powder, which is normally used for rearing kittens. And she said, oh, how are you going to do that? How are you going to give it? With this, I replied, and waved a little 2 mil syringe at her. So, I got the little baby. Very tricky, I have to say. Milk just squirted out of his mouth to start with. But actually, he cottoned on to what was required, and was soon suckling away to his heart's content. So we managed to get him to start using the milk, which was pretty good. Then, right, she said, my wife, I think he should have a teat. Oh, dear. Teeth, small one for a little thing like that. Now, clever lady, my wife. I'll find one, she said. She went on a lunchtime trip into town. Back she came, waving a baby doll's feeding set.
Oh, what good idea.
Really? Well, it was, wasn't it? I was really surprised and not convinced it would work. But sure enough, yeah, he did. And could see him afterwards, curled up, fast asleep, stomach full of milk. Now, browse the internet to discover how orphan squirrels have been fostered onto a cat with kittens. I thought, ah, right, we had one boarding in the hospital. She'd just given birth. Was it worth a try? Yep. I lined Cyril up against the three kittens next to their mum. I thought, oh, dear, perhaps the mum will turn round wondering what this is and sort of bite it and kill it. But she actually turned to give the kittens a lick, sniffed the squirrel, and I was there with my hand ready to snatch Cyril away. By the way, we called him Cyril, as you mentioned there. Another sniff from the female. Cat's head went lower and lower towards his little wriggling pink body. I thought, oh, it's going to, you know, really have a go at it. Cat's tongue darted out. Naked squirrel was lightly touched. And then she started licking it, actually washing, transferring her scent. Cyril had been accepted, and he started suckling from the cat. So 3 days later, his eyes opened, so really going great guns. He learnt to scrabble up the side of the cat's basket because he's got these large claws. He'd totter along the top, rolling from side to side like a drunken sailor. And gradually, as he became older, he started doing the typical squirrel-like movements, wild, erratic, all over the place. And of course, that was a temptation for canine and feline inpatients at the hospital. So he got transferred to our cottage, where we separated a section of the conservatory off with a wire mesh. And that became his home. And Maxine gave him bits and pieces of hay and straw, and he made a dray, his own nest. He came very tame, and he actually was to love sitting on my wife's shoulder, turning over a favourite tidbit in his paws, which was a custard cream. So he'd gnaw away at it, cheeks rapidly filling. So he'd end up actually going out into the garden, in the apple trees, sunbathing. And we thought, well, what are we going to do eventually with him? Because really, you're not allowed to keep squirrels under the special
act. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
It's against the law to keep.
Yeah, it is really. He found out for himself, actually. He went walkabout. He disappeared. Oh, dear. We must go and look for him, said Maxie. Dashed into the kitchen, saying she'd get some custard cream. So it was excruciating time of us walking around the local rec, calling out, Cyril, Cyril, where are you? Waving custard creams in the air. Local sort of mad, in actual fact, and no doubt reading too much Beatrix Potter. And I said, look, can't do this anymore, it's enough. So we had to leave it. Then, a week later, I spotted an elderly lady sitting on a park bench, and she had squirrels running up and back of the bench, all Cyril lookalikes. So I stopped to watch her, and she was taking all these bits of food from a plastic shopping bag, lumps of cheese, biscuits. Squirrels scuttled back and forth, snatching each item without any fear whatsoever. And she said, aren't they pretty? I said, yes. So tame, she said, yes. Especially this little dear chap. She glanced down at the squirrel who jumped onto her arm and was now clasping the biscuit she'd given. He looked like the others, I have to confess, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, tubby little tummy, all the attributes of a healthy squirrel. But there was something familiar about him, and it was the way he was devouring the biscuit in his paws, his sizes crunching through it. No other squirrel could surely enjoy a biscuit with such relish as he did. Yes, it had to be Cyril. And what clinched it? Why, the biscuit being eaten, of course, John. It was a custard cream.
Well, there we are. Nice one, Cyril. So, did you ever manage to rescue Cyril? Did you ever manage to get him back into your house?
No, we let him be on the wreck, because there are plenty of other squirrels around there. He seemed very happy. So, yeah. That was very contented.
Have you seen him since? Or?
Yes, several occasions. Really? Yes. Not always with a custard cream. But
Well, he's the one who comes up to and says, what you got for me today?
Exactly right.
Anyway, well, look, Malcolm, thank you very much indeed for the story of Cyril the Squirrel.
And now to Bridport, where the town was taken over by hundreds of mad hatters for the town's annual hat festival, in aid this year of two charities, Brain Tumour Research and the Brain Injury Rehabilitation Trust. The events featured a Mad Hatter's tea party, a hat auction, a hall full of hats for sale, and hat competitions for children, grown-ups and dogs. There was music in the square, dancing and entertainment. But first, let's get a flavour of the event from one of the organisers, Amanda Montague, accoutred in a flowing, diaphanous item, and of course, a very fetching hat. John takes up the story.
Amanda Montague, you are one of the organisers of the Hat Fair. Tell me, how long has it been going?
We're in the 9th year this year, and next year we'll be having a 10th year celebration.
Oh dear, well we'd better deal with the 9th year first of all. I mean, what started it? Why did all those years ago somebody decide that a hat festival was a good idea for Bridport?
Bridport has a hat shop, and it was begun by the organiser, the owner of the hat shop. And the idea was to raise money for charity as well as to promote hat wearing.
Hat wearing? Yeah, because of what it used to be. I mean, if you look at old pictures of the 1920s and 30s, everybody wore a hat.
Mm.
But it seems to have gone largely out of fashion. So are you hoping that Bridport on its own is going to bring back hat fashion? Hat wearing as a fashion?
I think to a degree it has. You see a lot of hats in Bridport, but particularly today when just about everyone wears them. People, children, dogs. It's just a lovely sort of celebration at the end of summer.
Yes, I've just seen a dog that was dressed up as a wasp, complete with gossamer wings. Now, tell me about your very fetching hat.
There's not much to say, really. It's just got lots of flowers on it, and it's quite cheap.
Oh.
It's very extravagant, but it's not.
Oh, now you spoil the illusion. But I have seen some amazing hats. Now, it's not only just hats, is it? It's all about charity as well. Yeah. So what other events are there?
We have a hat auction. We have raffles, quizzes. We have a Mad Hatter's Tea Party this afternoon where all the committee members are dressed in a very undignified way as Alice in Wonderland characters. We have an elegant hat competition. But the main event is the fun competition, which is about to take place, where everybody makes their own hats and they're incredibly extravagant and over the top. And that's the one that usually makes it into the papers because the pictures are incredible.
And tell me, you say it's been going for 9 years. I mean, has it just got bigger and better?
It has. I mean, as thousands of people descend on Bridport every year. Last year I spoke to people from Salisbury, from Bournemouth, from other parts of the country who have heard about it and love it. And we apparently have a very strong fan in Spain who I met, who spoke about it, who was into her hats, which was quite a surprise as well. It's well known.
And you yourself, what function do you perform?
General Dog's Body, I think.
Dog's Body?
No, I'm up on the stage trying to help organise.
Are you an auctioneer?
No, I'm not the auctioneer, thankfully.
Well, why do you say that?
It's not a job I'd want to do.
Oh, come on, you don't... wearing a hat like that, you can't be shy, can you?
No, not really. It's quite a flamboyant hat, granted.
So, now, what happens sort of at night with the hat festival? I mean, do you have functions in the evenings?
Yes, we have the hat auction on Thursday evening. We have bands. We've got dancing. There are activities going on Millennium Green at the other end of town as well. Dancing, as I say, the Mad Hatter's tea party. And hopefully for the ladies, the Prosecco van. We're all looking forward to that.
Well, there we are. There were hundreds upon hundreds of decorated hats and decorated people. It seems it's not enough to wear a creation on your head. You have to dress the part as well. Words, sadly, cannot do justice to some of the magnificent millinery creations. And here are some of the highlights, which appeal to me anyway. There was a kitchen stove, complete with a crooked chimney belching smoke, which was somehow connected to a hidden vaping machine, which was concealed on this gentleman's head. I especially liked a creation with fisherman's netting intertwined with seashells. There were several tiaras and crowns. There was even a speedway track on the brim of a hat, when there was another hat sporting a full tea service, and gruesomely, a builder's hard hat with a saw blade and nails spurting blood, depicting a very nasty accident at work. There was a scarecrow in a field of flowers, or it might have been a scarecrow in a weedy field of corn, who could tell. There were lots of bowlers, decorated and painted, and I rather liked something rather simple. It was a gent in a Confederate Army hat. But strangely, the hat that sort of, well, really stopped me in my tracks wasn't really a hat at all, Andy. There was a gingery coloured dog dressed up as a wasp with black markings and yellow stripes and a pair of enormous gossamer wings. Now, in the hall where hat traders were selling all manner of hats, some sporting crazy designs, others featuring serious examples of the milliner's art. But I found a lady whose hats take biodiversity to a new level. Her name is Maggie Whiteman, and she is a sheep hatter. Yep, I'll repeat that, a sheep hatter. Now, all will be plumb clear as I let her explain. Now, I'm sitting behind a stand, actually, which is full of very, very colourful hats. And the most amazing thing is that they are, well, bio hats, I suppose you could say. Maggie, you tell me all about your hats and how you make them.
We have a small organic farm in Devon, and my husband shears the sheep, and then I wash the fleeces, dye the fleeces myself, and then use that dyed fleece for making hats and felted hats, which everyone is different.
Well, yes, because yes, they're all one-offs, aren't they? So take me back a little bit further then. You have a farm and you have some... How many sheep do you have?
About 30 plus followers.
Oh dear, what's a follower?
Well, the lambs and just hangers-on.
I see. And so you really do absolutely everything yourself. There's not an element to your hat making which is prefabricated.
Oh, not at all, no. And when I do the decoration, I actually use either silks or other sort of fleece bits and things to felt in at the time.
Now, you're a very sane hatter among a lot of mad hatters. What on earth gave you the idea of making organic hats?
I don't really know. I just thought it was quite a fun thing to do, and then the name Felt Like a Hat came, and so that's what I've been trading under.
So there are no milliners in your family?
No, not at all.
So how many hats do you make then? I mean, is there a production line? Have you got anybody helping you?
I don't have anybody helping me at all. I think at the maximum I was taking about 140 to a festival.
I see. And how long does it take you to make a hat then? Because, as you say, they're all different.
I can make a hat in a day, but of course prior to that I've washed the fleece, dyed it, carded it, designed the hat. And then after the hat is made, I have to sew in a headband in most of them. But the actual felting I can do in a day.
Okay. And how many hats do you suppose you've made over the course of the years?
I would think probably it must be in the high hundreds.
I think it's wonderful, actually. So thank you very much indeed for talking to us. And you've got to get back to your hat stand and make some sales, haven't you?
That's right. Yes, it's quite busy.
Thank you so much.
Now then, this would not be Ridgeway Magazine without some fascinating facts about hats. So let's try some phrases containing the word hat and find out their derivation. To have a feather in your cap dates back to bygone days of the brave soldier. Wearing one indicated the soldier had either killed the enemy or done something courageous, and this action would permit the wearing of a feather in the hat. Red Indian braves had much the same idea. At the drop of a hat means something that starts instantly and comes from the fact races or contests began in olden times when the starter dropped his hat. To throw your hat in the ring originated in America when barkeepers would erect a ring so that any belligerent customers could fight amongst themselves rather than involving the whole bar in a free-for-all. Anyone who wanted to challenge a fighter would throw his hat in the ring.
So now you know. Now, to hold on to your hats is a warning that something exciting or dangerous is about to happen. Finally, to keep something under your hat comes from the time when you might be out and about in the street and you had important papers or even jewellery, and you'd put them for safekeeping under your hat to keep them away from prying eyes and thieves. And to keep something under your hat also meant to keep something secret and not to be discussed, like keep it dark.
Keep 106.
Now then, let's move on. There are some sounds that are so British you hardly need reminding what they are. For example, Big Ben's chimes, a chuffing steam locomotive, the haunting sound of a bugle playing the last post. And this. Well, not quite in the same nostalgic league, but how about this sound? Well, the first sound was that of a Spitfire from the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight, which entertained crowds on the Esplanade during Carnival Week. But it was a pity it was so far out to sea, because it was actually quite difficult to view unless you had binoculars, really. That's elfin safety for you. Anyway, the best place to see it and other air displays is from the vantage point offered at the end of the pier or the battlements of the Nothe Fort. And the second sound came from the engine of an armed personnel carrier that looks a bit like a small tank. It headed the Weymouth Carnival procession. It's now in captivity and living quietly in Dorchester. Until it fires up his engines, that is. John couldn't resist sitting inside its armour-plated hull, pretending to be a soldier, while he talked to its owner.
Well, this has to be the ultimate in a big boy's toy. Corman Gilman, tell me about your tank. Well, it isn't actually a tank, but we'll pretend it is. We're sitting inside it. Now, tell me, how did you come by it?
I left the forces in 95, and I saw this come up on a paintball website. And I decided to buy it, and a few years later, to put it to good use, raising money for Help the Heroes, and I attend all the other charity events to help raise money.
You make it sound very, very simple. It wasn't as simple as that, because was it in a bit of a state when you got it?
Yes, it was a major disrepair. It needed new tracks on it, needed repainting, the engine needed overhauling. So it was about a year restoration, getting up and running again.
That doesn't sound very long. Now, you were in the army. What were you doing in the army? Because you told me you were in the Gulf War.
Yeah, I was in 27 Royal Artillery, attached to 2nd Field.
So you weren't driving tanks?
No, I was driving ammunition trucks and the M109 self-propelled gun.
So driving an armoured vehicle carrier? What is this exactly?
Yeah, this is the AFV 432, which is a multi-role track vehicle. This one in particular is a troop carrier. It carries 10 soldiers onto the battlefield. It can also be used as a mortar base plate, ambulance, anti-aircraft. It's designed for anything.
Now, it's very unlikely you'll ever run out of fuel. Why is that?
This is a multi-fuel vehicle, as I said, and it runs on aviation fuel, chip fat oil, engine oil, anything that's come from the ground, it will burn it.
Now, there was a lesson learnt from the Second World War, wasn't there, from the German panzer tanks, which were huge beasts.
Yeah, the Tiger 1 and Tiger 2 were the heaviest main battle tanks during the war, because during the Second World War, the vehicles were petrol. The Germans kept running out. So the War Office after the war asked companies to design an engine that is multi-fuel.
Now, you attend many events, don't you? Raising money for?
I raise money for Help the Heroes, the Poppy Appeal, and also local charities as well.
So here you are in Weymouth Carnival. It's the first time you've been to the Weymouth Carnival.
Yes, I was asked by the Carnival Committee while I was on Veterans Weekend to attend Weymouth Carnival, and they said it is for charity, and I says yes, no problem, I'll attend.
Now, your daytime job hasn't got anything to do with tanks, but it has to do with vehicles.
Yes, I drive the big car transporters with 12 or 13 cars on at any one time.
So, where do you keep this beast?
I keep this in Somerset, a place called Hazelbury Mill. The chap who owns it, Roger Bastable, lets me keep my truck and this vehicle up there free of charge.
Now, that must be some distance away from Weymouth, so how do you get the tank to Weymouth?
I have a DROPS, which is a demountable rack offload pickup system. Basically, it lowers a flatbed onto the floor. I drive the 432 onto the flatbed, chain it down and lift it onto the back of the truck.
It's just as simple. You make it sound terribly simple, is it?
Yep, simple as that. Just got to be careful when you're strapping it down that the chains are tight, and otherwise it'll snap and the thing will fall off.
Well, we can't have that, not in the middle of a carnival. So how many occasions are you out and about raising money for Help the Heroes?
This is my 14th show this year, and I've got probably another 3 or 4 to go, including the Poppy Appeal in November, as it's the centenary of the First World War.
I see. So for this... is it a veteran tank, or is that being disrespectful?
This one's a veteran. It was made in 1966. It's still in service today, but it's got a newer engine, uprated suspension and steering.
I see. Well, look, I'm sure Help the Heroes must be very grateful, because have you any idea how much money you've raised?
Not offhand. I've got a bucket, and it's security sealed. So once I've finished all my shows, the bucket goes back to Help the Heroes sealed, and they'll let me know at a later date how much I've raised.
Right, well, let's hope that people are feeling very generous in Weymouth today. Thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgeway Magazine. We haven't quite finished with military matters yet. At the popular D-Day Centre in Castletown, you will see several military vehicles, including an American tank, which you can climb into, and you can climb on the other vehicles as well. Great fun. But while I was there, I met Ian Dunford, who rebuilds World War II Jeeps, literally from piles of scrap, bodywork and engine parts. It's a hobby, but he will help enthusiasts with running problems. I was invited into his workshop nearby, and we talked amidst the parts and spares and all sorts of paraphernalia that will eventually be rebuilt into a Willys Jeep as authentic as the day it was made in 1945. If you want to see historical military vehicles on the road, come to Dorset. There are museums, there are carnivals, there are shows, and this is where you will see old-fashioned military vehicles. Now, Ian Dunford, you are a Jeep expert. You restore historical World War II Jeeps, and I'm in your, shall I say, garage or lockup, and I'm surrounded by literally bits and pieces. There's bodywork here. There's all sorts of things that wouldn't make any sense to me at all. And then sitting in the middle of the workshop is a chassis, four wheels, a gearbox and a steering wheel. Oh, and a radiator. Ian, how do you make sense of all this?
It's just something I've learnt over the years. And you take them apart, you make a note of where everything goes, and you put them back together again. It do make sense to me. Bell housing down there, two halves of a body, and eventually lots of work goes on and it all comes back together and creates a vehicle again.
Right, absolutely amazing, because you will see Jeeps in Weymouth being used every day. Have you got one?
Yes, I have one. I use mine every day. The curator of the D-Day Museum uses his every day. And people do get to know us. They see us driving around, and it's always good, nice to get waves. They seem to be a feel-good vehicle as well. People like looking at them, like seeing them going. And they're fun for us as well.
Now, then, it's amazing, isn't it, that in fact there's still so many Jeeps on the road. Were very many made?
Roughly 700,000. A mix of Ford and Willys. Ford's made slightly less than Willys. We don't actually know how many are left in the world, but obviously there's quite a few because you see them fairly regularly.
Now, of course, a lot of them would have had to have been restored. I don't suppose there are very many Willys or Ford Jeeps made in 1945 which are actually still running as perfect examples.
Probably a few more than you'd imagine. They're not commonplace, but there are quite a few around, and obviously people like myself slowly bringing them back to life. And so it's hard to quantify a figure, but certainly they're not rare. But, you know, as I say, you will see them, and you'll see them at shows. You'll see, you know, 20, 30 of them at shows. Quite a lot in Dorset. So that just adds to it, because at least you get the chance to see how other people do it, what their standards are like, etc., and what their Jeeps are like.
So, given that there are quite a lot running around, I mean, where on earth do you find the parts? Because is it very difficult to find parts for an authentic Jeep?
There are copy parts made in China and other countries which are fairly easily obtainable, but quality's sometimes a bit suspect. But the original parts, new old stock parts, those you just have to just keep looking in Europe generally and around the world, and basically buy them when they come up for sale.
So you don't import bits and pieces parts from America then?
Try not to at the moment, mainly because their postage is very expensive and customs as well gets added on. So if you can source it in the EU, obviously all the local taxes are paid, it just arrives at your door the next day.
Well, we won't talk about Brexit, will we? But so after the war, when there were quite a lot of Jeeps around, because I can remember farmers having them, in fact the farmer next door to us had a Jeep, after the war did people sort of buy up Jeeps and spare parts, lock, stock and barrel, and sort of ferret it, or rather put them away somewhere?
Yeah, there used to be, most of them have gone now, but there used to be back in the 80s and 90s several people in the country that had fields full of spares that they bought army surplus. But as they've got elderly and passed away, their families have tended to either scrap everything and weigh it in for the scrap value, or sell them off. So the big places have more or less disappeared, but there's still little pockets of stuff around. And as you know, I found a 1949 brand new starter for my restoration I'm doing now, which is looking like being my Jeep, and they just don't come up for sale.
Now, let's talk about the value of a fully restored Jeep. I mean, are there various stratas of prices? I mean, is there an entry-level price and then another price for a perfect example?
Yeah, I mean, if you buy what I would call an average Jeep, registered, quite capable of going straight onto the road, maybe non-original parts in some places, but looks the part, you're probably looking at £15,000. If you want to go the whole hog, strip it completely, all new bearings, etc., over all the engine, you more or less double that. and get up to 30,000, 32,000.
Now, what you do is really a hobby, so there's no point in anybody sort of rocking up to your lockup and saying, can you fix my Jeep? So who are the people that you can help?
Well, obviously, I'm involved with the D-Day Museum, and I know the lads there. So if they go, as they did this year, to Normandy, and they work the Jeeps hard and break them, invariably I fix them for them. They get the parts, or they pay for the parts. And as part of our group, I just do the work to keep them on the road, and because I want to see the vehicles going as well. And if someone was at the museum, had an issue with a vehicle, regardless of what vehicle, I would try and keep them on the road, because we don't need these vehicles parked at the side of the road broken down. But it's not a garage. I don't advertise. It's just really friends and acquaintances that I just enjoy keeping their vehicles going.
Now, if you had a dream and the fairy godmother of military vehicles were to wave a wand and say, you can have whatever you like, what would you have? Because I know it won't be a Jeep.
No, it would be a short wheelbase hard cab GMC without a winch, which is quite a rare vehicle, but they're my personal favourite. The biggest problem is that they're quite large and they're hard to store, but that would be my own personal choice.
Well, there we are. Silly, I asked, really. Now then, there's a little gem in today's Echo. It's a letter from a reader called Rodney Best. I'll read it to you. A top neurosurgeon, he writes, is about to attempt the first ever brain transplant, and he was phoning UK hospitals for a suitable donor, and of course he needed to know the cost. On being told that DCH had a possible donor, he requested the price and was staggered when told it was £1 million. That's outrageous, he fumed. What makes that brain 10 times the price of all the others I've sourced? Well, Professor Kamen replied, it belonged to a member of the local planning committee that opposes the building of a desperately needed relief road to one of the largest man-made harbours on the planet. That would improve the quality of life for thousands and help regenerate the most economically deprived area in the UK. So you see, this brain comes totally unused. Thank you for that.
Dear. Yes.
Isn't that wonderful?
Wonderful. Well, that's where we must wrap up the programme for this week, John, I think.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Andy, for producing the programme, as always. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And this has been a Ridgeway Radio production. Goodbye for now.
Keep 106.